Okay, so good morning, everybody. I want to welcome everyone here. I think there are still some folks who will be dialing in because we have just under 100 folks signed up today, but we're going to get started. It's 2 minutes after the hour, and we need all the time we can get today with Jett and Marlena. I'm Noah Rubenstein, the director of GoodTherapy.org, and I'm pleased to welcome all of you here. This is our first event in our 2009 workshop series. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have Jett Saris and Marlena Lyons here today to tell us about their work and the power of undefended love. I'm going to introduce Jett and Marlena in a minute, but first a handful of announcements. I want you to know that we're going to be doing the teleconference today in Q&A mode, and that means everyone is automatically muted. And we do this because of having 100 people on the line can create a lot of feedback. So we do welcome you to speak up during question and answer periods and during check-in periods, and Jett and Marlena will prompt you for that. You can unmute your phone by pressing *6 on your telephone keypad. Again, you can unmute your phone as needed by pressing *6 on your telephone keypad. When you press *6, you'll hear a message letting you know that you're unmuted, and you can toggle back and forth between unmute and mute as often as you need by pressing *6. Second, if for any reason you get disconnected from the teleconference, please know you can dial back in using the same dial-in number and code. It doesn't happen often, but occasionally it does. Third, you should have received a reminder email yesterday, which included a link where you could download a handout to supplement the presentation. If you registered this morning or for any reason you didn't receive that email, you can download it by going to www.goodtherapy.org/download. Again, that's goodtherapy.org/download. About CEU certificates, if you'd like a CEU certificate for today, you'll need to do three things. First, prepare to write down the start code, which I'm going to give out in a moment. Two, at the end of the workshop, we'll give out the end code. You'll need to write that down also. Third, you'll need to complete our online survey. In the survey, you'll be prompted to enter the start and end codes. That lets us know that you've attended the entire workshop. To access the survey and get your CEUs, please go to goodtherapy.org, log into the members area, and in the left-hand menu, you'll see a link that reads Request CEU Certificate. And once you've completed that, we'll email you a certificate within a week or two. And I will also email all of these instructions to everyone here following the teleconference. If you have any questions that haven't been answered, please feel free to email Tom in support at support@goodtherapy.org. Again, Tom in customer support is his email is support@goodtherapy.org. Or you can ask me. I'll stick around after the presentation to take questions. So I'm going to give out the start code now. The start code is the word love. And the start code is the word love, L-O-V-E, love. And at the end of the presentation, I'll give out the ending code. So please write that down if you want CEUs. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jett and Marlena. For the sake of time, I will be using Jett and Marlena's abbreviated biography to introduce them, but I wanted to say that I so much enjoyed reading their bios. I appreciated how transparent and vulnerable they were and thought they were offering a good model for living undefended as a professional, even in their bios. And, you know, living undefended is something many of us struggle to do professionally. And, you know, I imagine that some of you had a chance to read their bios when you learned about the workshop, but if you haven't yet, I think you'll enjoy hearing about the unique stories and struggles they each experienced along the road to finding their passion and purpose in undefended love. So Jett Saris, PhD, and Marlena Lyons, PhD, are co-founders of the Conscious Living Center, a counseling and workshop center in the San Francisco Bay Area. They've been leading seminars and retreats which guide couples and individuals to cultivate the capacity for undefended love since 1990. Marlena has been in private practice specializing in relationship issues since 1979. Jett came to the field of psycho-spiritual work in 1988 after a decade in business as an executive in several high-profile companies. Through their work together, they have gone beyond researching the reasons why people have failed to create exceptional relationships and have developed a unique approach to accelerate personal and relationship development to allow individuals to connect with themselves and each other in an undefended and open way. Jet and Marlena have authored a wonderful book together, Undefended Love, and they offer many different workshops, including a foundation course on undefended love, which begins February 7th and 8th. In addition to their work in undefended love, Jet and Marlena are branching out into the realm of midlife material, and they have an upcoming book called Taking the Midlife Leap One Step at a Time. Both Jet and Marlena are in private practice and offer sessions in person, over the phone, and by Skype. For more information about Jet and Marlena, their books, their workshops, or their practices, you can visit their website at www.undefendedlove.com. That's www.undefendedlove.com, and that's no spaces, no hyphens, just undefendedlove.com. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to welcome Jet and Marlena with us here today.
So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning, everyone.
And thank you, Noah, and our contact person, Whitney, and the rest of the staff at goodtherapy.org, whom we haven't met, but we can still feel you operating in the background. And we especially want to thank everybody who's joined us today and taken time out of your busy lives to be with us. We'd like to just kind of establish a field this morning, so if everyone could close their eyes for a moment and orient themselves more toward the epicenter of their being and kind of tune into a deeper level so that what we do today speaks to the understanding that everybody on the line today is part of a tribe, you know, part of a very important network of angels that are really working hard in the trenches, one-on-one. A lot of people are getting kind of the limelight with the 1,000 to 1, but the real work in our mind occurs in that one-on-one personal contact. So first make that one-on-one contact with yourself, from which all the other points of contact will find a natural meeting place. And even in your mind, kind of connect the dots of the constellation of this morning's meeting. So, you know, we have people calling in from the Bahamas, Illinois, New York, Wisconsin, Oregon, Florida, Arizona, Iowa. I don't know why no one mentioned Nevada and Montana. Did we skip two states? But hopefully they're joining us in one way or another. It's hard to sometimes do the work one-on-one without connecting into the tribe. So what Good Therapy is doing is good therapy for all of us, really helping us stay connected to the work and bring us into deep relationship with each other and our own work. So Marlene and I last night were talking about the person who epitomizes this, and we think of Mother Teresa. Because right up to the last years of her life, she still went out to the streets and sat with dying people. And even though she could raise more money than any other person on the planet, she never felt like that was her true work or her true calling. She really knew that her true calling was what happened on the street, in the gutter, with a person who was looking at her for a moment's respect, a moment's contact. A hello, soul to soul. And our work is about developing the capacity to say that hello in every ever-deepening ways, levels. So, okay.
And just to add to that, I think the couples work is particularly challenging for many reasons, as you, I think, have experienced. But I think it's to remember that you've got, you know, by the time people enter your office as a couple, they've both feel and have felt mutually wounded by each other. So there's a particularly raw element, even as it's covered up by kind of a lot of defenses and maybe blaming and all the things we're going to be talking about. But I think it's important to acknowledge that that rawness is being stirred up in us as therapists in a much greater fashion than when we just work with one person. And also there's the call or the hope in each one of the mates in the partnership that the witness, that the therapist will find one person to blame and will vindicate them. So there's all that energy that's swirling around that we're sort of being pulled on a personality level to respond to. But what we're also going to be talking about is what's being called on from us as therapists on a soul level to solidify that ground between all of us, even as we need to relate to the personality.
So we thought we'd start today's talk with a poem by Hafiz. He's an Iranian mystic and poet whom some of you may know. And the poem kind of talks very nicely to the portion of Undefended Love we wanted to address this morning. So the poem is entitled, Tired of Speaking Sweetly. Love wants to reach out and manhandle us, break all our teacup talk of God. If you had the courage and could give the beloved his choice, some night he would just drag you around the room by your hair, ripping from your grip all those toys in the world that bring you no joy. Love sometimes gets tired of speaking sweetly and wants to rip to shreds all your erroneous notions of truth that make you fight within yourself, dear one, and with others, causing the world to weep on too many fine days. God wants to manhandle us, lock us up inside a tiny room with himself and practice his drop kick. The beloved sometimes wants to do us a great favor, hold us upside down and shake all the nonsense out. But when we hear he is in such a playful drunken mood, most everyone I know quickly packs their bags and hightails it out of town. So this poem talks about the movement in our mind from a stage of relating we call closeness, which is when love speaks sweetly and we feel loved, to the place where we call intimacy, which is when God really wants to lock us in a room and practice his drop kick. And intimacy feels like that. Feels like everything is out of your control. And in contrast, the sweet part, closeness, we feel good. We feel in control. So, and the last line of the poem is my favorite poem, a part of the poem, because it is true that everyone comes in and talks about, I really want an intimate partnership. The moment, though, that we're on the cusp of that possibility, everyone quickly packs their bags and hightails it out of town. So that's the place we're going. That oscillation between closeness and intimacy is what we thought we might address this morning.
Which is what the handout speaks to, is some of the differences between what we call personality-centered relationship, which brings about closeness, and essential-centered, undefended relationship, which leads to intimacy. And the thing that's always a surprise for all of us as people and couples and therapists is to remember that when we encounter a problem, you know, whatever the problem is that people come in with into the session, the problem is actually a demarcation that spells out that you've come to some threshold, and you've taken closeness as long as you've been able to in your relationship, where there's been the ability to make agreements, to negotiate, to reflect each other accurately and well in the ways we want to be reflected. And so all those skills that I think we'll spend a little bit of time, just not much, but just a little bit of time delineating as to what constitutes closeness, at some point those patterns, behaviors, skills actually break down. And we encounter that, we experience that as a problem. Our partner's not showing up the way we want them to. They're not giving us the kind of response they used to. They criticize us. There's stress in the relationship. And so when people come into our offices, those strategies, the actually healthy strategies that they've developed, are beginning to break down. And so the misunderstanding at that point is usually that the relationship is failing. And our premise is that the relationship is actually succeeding on a soul level, in the sense that it's kind of wearing out kind of the personality path and beginning to open a door for a shift in relating and calling us to look for what's being called for actually in a different place, in a deeper part of our being.
So if we look at the elements of closeness briefly, if you're having an experience where you feel safe, comfortable, and in control, you're basically having an experience of closeness. And that obviously can be achieved in an unhealthy way or a healthy way. But if we just look at the healthy elements, we use an acronym in the book called REACT. And it delineates the elements that create a healthy, close relationship. We need the capacity to be reciprocal. We need to be able to have a healthy level of entitlement so that we can ask for what we need and receive that and believe that we deserve that. We need an element of approval to support us in our endeavors. We need to be able to compromise and negotiate in order to create a consensual reality. And there needs to be a level of trust in the relationship. And so we acknowledge that all of those are important developmental achievements. But when we cling to closeness and don't actually, as Marlena was saying, we don't actually reply to the call to move beyond that stage, we end up preventing rather than promoting intimacy. And we almost begin to create a decaying process as opposed to walking through the portal willingly, in a sense, to kind of, I always say in my sessions, you know, okay, especially when they're very, very hot, okay, now's the time to don your white initiate robes and recognize that you're going to go into battle in some sense. You're going to have to endure something that is going to be difficult. So sometimes we compare the movement in closeness from, you know, the early stages of a caterpillar moving from a larva to caterpillar, where we're developing strategies that continue to work and give us that feeling of safety, comfort, and control. But the work of intimacy really happens in the cocoon. We'll talk about that, but hopefully you can see that when you improve your strategies to maintain safety, closeness, safety, comfort, and control, you're actually adding layers of defense. You're actually becoming more defensive. And that's going to produce a bigger need for a bigger break.
And that's really why we called the book Undefended, even though after we titled it, we realized there really was no such word in the dictionary.
Not at the time, at least.
Not at the time, which is interesting. But we used the word undefended in order to shine a light on two levels of defense. The usual, traditional understanding of what defensive behavior is when you're blaming, attacking, criticizing, you know, making the other person wrong. We know that, you know, traditionally. The second level of defense that's not commonly seen as a defended structure in our being is what we're calling the compensatory personality. We're just going to call it personality for now. So the person I think I am is usually, we usually identify with the personality. And that's, as Jet was saying, that's actually what creates closeness, is the personality. To the degree that it's functional or dysfunctional, it's the personality. But it also breaks down or wants to break down in order to become intimate. You really cannot achieve intimacy through the personality. Why? Because the personality actually arises and is born out of our familial environment, and it therefore can only reproduce that same environment. And just to make a long story short, that the personality is a limited aspect of who we are. But many qualities of being, many aspects and characteristics and soul, the soul face of who we are is actually put in the background. But we identify with the personality. What happens when we identify with something? We defend it. We defend it with our life. So the crux, usually of relationship struggle, is that we go into relationship, and actually that's how we enter relationship, wanting and hoping that our personality, this identity whom we think we are, is reinforced and encouraged and validated and praised. And at the point where it stops being seen as so wonderful is where the problem arises, because it actually wants to dissolve the personality. But the more we're identified with the personality, the more resistant we become to this to the dissolving, and we have a problem as we see it. And we begin then to enlist the higher or lower level of defenses that we talked about. Then we enter criticism and blaming and attacking, reacting, which is another crux in relationship, the reactivity, the emotional reactivity that arises when your personality is being challenged.
So a couple comes into your office, and each one says their point of view in a charged or less charged manner, and they're pulling on the therapist, as Marlena said earlier, to validate where they are. And you can either work individually with each person, validating their particular position, or you can work with the field that lies between the two people. And the first thing you would say if you're working with the field is, good job. This is wonderful that you have brought yourself to a position where you can actually take your next step. Because our next step isn't taken on solid ground. I often say that, you know, really life, we're just giant lily pads on a huge ocean, and the next step is into water. And, you know, there's water between each lily pad. And so you validate the relationship, the field of the relationship, for accomplishing getting each person to their edge of their development. And so then you begin to actually turn the attention of the client to the field. And then the next thing you say is, don't touch the problem. We need the problem to keep us in the water. So we want to leave the problem intact, and we want to allow it to have its catalytic, transformative, or dissolving effect on us.
So normally we see the problem really as a pointer. The problem is pointing to the limits of the personality. If the personality had the skills or the ability, the tools, the resources to resolve the problem, they wouldn't be where they are. So we say, let's leave the problem as it is and see it as that pointer, as that pathway that identifies the limit of your own development. It says, this is as far as you've come. And traditional psychotherapy would say, let's fix the problem. Let's give you a better way to do your personality, a better way to make requests, a better way to express your anger. And all those are valuable. But if you hear what fixing implies, it's like fixing it so that it works like it used to work. So it's actually kind of a regressive method, which we all need to go through, but after a while, the regressive method becomes a recycled method, which is why you'll see couples recycle the problem, or they keep processing, and they can't quite get through the birth canal. They just keep going around that same cul-de-sac and reinforcing, albeit a higher level or better level of programs, but they're still within the field of the personality type that they're familiar with.
So the couple walks in the room,
You validate the field between them, which is you align with the relationship field. You congratulate them on the successful move to expanding that field. And you ask them to take their eyes off their partner and off the problem. The problem, as Marlena says, identifies or maps the terrain. But once the terrain is mapped, the couple or the individuals actually enter what we call cocoon work. That's the process of dissolving structure, not resolving a problem. And in that cocoon work, what happens is you take your eye off the other, and we all know that basically no matter what we say, no matter how often we say it as guides, we just really always just want the other to change so we can feel better. And so even people who are the most advanced on this, when they get into the crunch, it's, I just want to feel better. And you grab for whatever strategy you can to do that. So as a guide, you make allowance for those little grabs. And, you know, don't reach out, you know, and you want to keep bringing them back into the direct experience of the disturbance. Personality was created to remedy a disturbance. And so every time we have an issue in relationship that creates a disturbance, we have just allowed an alchemical process to begin, and our attention has to go vertically, not horizontally, vertically to the disturbance. So we're going to actually ask you to do this for yourselves now for a moment, and then we're going to open it up to some dialogue. So let's see. So why don't you think about somebody who can reliably trigger you in your life. Let's do this personally as opposed to thinking about a client. Think about someone who can drive you nuts, push your buttons, send you over the edge, and if you're not in primary partnership, you can always think about a mother. Your mother would be good, but you could think about my mother. And just imagine them walking in and doing that thing that drives you nuts. Or if what drives you nuts is that they actually aren't walking in, you can use that. So, but you need to bring this into your body. You need to have a direct experience of that place where you want to explode or contract or go numb, or and you need to allow yourself to have that very uncomfortable experience now. So I'm going to just be silent for a few moments to really give you time to, you have to feel this for this conversation to go forward. And then just name for yourself, what is the edge for you? We're not mapping here. What is so uncomfortable about your direct experience? It may be sensations. It may be a feeling. What is so unendurable in that contracted place for you? And what we're asking always is, what is the experience you're having of yourself in yourself that this trigger is stimulating? So you may say, well, what's really unbearable is that the other person is not seeing me or yelling at me or criticizing me or whatever it is. So bring it back home and ask, what is it that it irritates inside of you? How do you end up seeing yourself? How do you end up feeling? So that it's back into that vertical movement, as Jet was saying, so we can begin to become more acclimated to embracing and connect with the actual experience that's being evoked within us. Okay, so if some of you can unmute yourselves and just say a couple of words about what the experience that feels so intolerable is, what those experiences are.
Yeah, and I would just remind everybody now that you can unmute by pressing *6 on your keypad.
I can talk a little bit. This is Linda Nussbaum from Long Beach.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. I visualized the relationship I have with my mother, and the part that is challenging for me has to do with her largesse. She's very big and demanding at times, and it just feels very overwhelming. I feel very small, and the feeling is I'm unimportant and non-existent.
Great. And
did you say her largeness?
Yes, her largeness.
Okay.
She's
okay. Huge. I swear to God, I thought you said her large ass. Sorry, I was really stunned there.
We'll work with you on that, Noah, a little later on.
Yeah, that was a glimpse into my psyche. Thank you, everyone.
So, Linda?
Yes. Rage.
Okay, yeah. So, and just before the rage...
Oh, just help me stop this.
Okay. Yeah, so the help me stop this is the direct experience, and the rage is the attempt to remedy it. And those two, we have to break those two down, because if you can remain in the direct experience of help me, without any remedy or any possibility or hope for remedy. And can you do that with me right now?
Yes. What? Please describe again what you need me to do.
Stay with the experience of help me, with no hope of remedy or resolving that experience.
It's very new and scary.
Yeah. So just open to that, breathe with that, in a very gentle way, closely attuned and interested in the movements of your subtle nature here. So it's scary, it's a little hard to tolerate, but just see if you can be a little soft around that and a little bit more spacious. Just give it a few more moments of room, a few more breaths, and just notice what you experience.
It's easing. It's flattening. Yes.
And in the process of easing, which is a relief from the contraction, can you notice a tendril, a subtle experience of self that's present now that wasn't a moment ago?
Yes.
And can you name that?
It's a feeling of flatness.
Flatness.
And yes, as if my tightness has become flat.
Okay.
Flat in a horizontal way.
Okay.
Meaning what? Good.
And so the flatness is a continuation of the easing of the contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And as you allow the flatness to kind of ripple out and let that kind of ripple out as it is, what do you notice about how you experience yourself now? And this is a tough thing to name often.
I would say that I'm less reacting, less reactive, less sensitive, less triggered, less, there's less kinetic energy around me, in me.
And so there's less of that, which is in relationship to contraction, and what begins to show up, what new piece is present that wasn't present before?
A piece. Peacefulness.
Yeah, P-E-A-C-E.
Correct.
Yeah. So, yeah, just if you can just settle with that for a moment. So what Linda did with lightning speed, and this will not happen necessarily this way in your client session, is she just moved through by attending to her own self, not managing her mother, by attending to her own self. She moved through a contraction, and I want to know, just point out some of my kind of guidance here. What almost everyone does is they will keep relating to the contraction. I feel less this, which is a relationship to the contraction, instead of I'm beginning to notice that something new. And the peace is actually an essential quality. It is when we relate to our contraction, we open up a doorway to allow life to rise up through us and give us what support we actually need to meet a particular issue outside of ourselves. But we don't earn that support until we can meet the experience inside ourselves.
So what Linda did is develop intimacy with her own experience. And what we learn is that we can only be intimate with another to the degree that we can be intimate with ourselves. The reason that is so is that when someone triggers an experience with us, in us, as Linda was talking about with her mom, instead of really being, you know, we're always talking about wanting to be present, right? What does that mean in a very real, practical way? It's really being open and available and present to the experience that's being stimulated in us. So she developed a sense of intimacy, and therefore, as she said accurately, she then no longer needed to be reactive. And the reactivity is there as a result to push away our attention from the experience that we're having, to actually stop the experience that we're having. So if Linda were to be allow herself to just react, she would not have tapped into that experience of feeling unimportant, that crying out of help me, and then all the things that proceeded from that. She stayed at the edge of her comfort zone. And as she said, you know, this is not comfortable, not easy, not usual. The edge is where we don't feel good about ourselves. It takes us beyond the capacity that we've developed as a personality. And we have difficulty dealing with that edge. We think we can't stand it. We think we're going to be destroyed by it. And what Jet was guiding is opening up an expectation, in a sense, of that, and a truth that when we meet ourselves there at the edge, we organically begin to develop something that is actually needed, that we are cut off from, and we are suffering from that separation. But we don't usually know how to be, how to hold it in such a way that it actually invites that quality of being that Jet was saying, that just arises on its own. We usually short-circuit that process, and we try to manufacture what quality or what skill or what capacity we think we need. We say, oh, well, what I need to do here is to be forgiving of my mom, or what I need to do is to establish my boundaries, or what I, you know, whatever, that we have lists and lists. And, you know, in one aspect of psychological repairing, that is very true. But when you use a relationship as a path of unfolding, or when you do psychotherapy as a path of unfolding, you don't encourage those kinds of developments. You encourage something that evolves within you organically.
Yeah, so we'll open it up to questions in a moment, but just one more piece on this is we're often asked why we don't teach a professional course in this work, and one of the reasons is that the guide has to have developed their own ability to traverse this territory and open up their own doorway to allow the session to actually
be out of their control. And they have to be, you know, willing to kind of do that in the field with the couple or with the individual they're working with, and have some faith, really, that that life is going to move through them and through the field in a way that is for everyone's evolution in the room. And that's a kind of a risky place. A little bit in the early days when I was doing some perinatal and prenatal breath work, I would notice that a lot of the guides would, you know, the moment the person started turning blue and couldn't breathe, they'd freak and think, oh my God, I'm gonna lose my entire livelihood here because this person's gonna die on the mat in front of me. And they'd kind of bring the person back. And so that's a re-traumatizing event. But if you've kind of gone through the blue baby sequence enough times your own self, you do develop a faith that that is going to actually resolve. And you're able to hold the space for the client to find their own way to faith. And so it's a developmental
capacity
that we have to work on all the time in the therapeutic context, to keep opening to these frightening places where, oh, I'm supposed to be the one who knows what to do next, and to really allow ourselves to not know and to, when appropriate, show that and bring that into the conversation.
And unlike Linda's example of her vertical drop, as we call it, when you take clients through that process, you'll experience and actually you'll get a map of their defensive strategies, because they'll begin to go into dialogue with you as to, you know, why this isn't right or why this isn't fair or how frightening it is, or there'll be kind of a series of attempts to stop that drop. And you will then begin to identify their strategies, the identity that is being threatened and challenged, what sense of deficiency, which actually Linda started to talk about, sense of not being important. So, you know, we can talk about that a little bit after we get some questions.
So we'll open up to questions now for a little bit, and then we'll continue. Are there any questions?
And you can unmute your phone by pressing *6.
Any situations you have, you know, with a client that you feel particularly,
it seems
inspired
to me,
by?
If this is Nicole, hi.
Hi, Nicole.
It seems to me, and this mirrors what I'm doing personally and in my professional life and private practice, is that you're really, and way beyond what I'm going to say now, is that you're elaborating very well on this idea that the only way out is through, and that and unless I'm misunderstanding you, it seems as if what you were saying before is that we get stuck. Our fears and anxieties and patterns and so forth that are expressed with defensiveness and blaming and all those things, that if we can persevere and push through the edge, as you call it, which I think is a really good way of thinking of it, then we can get to the other side.
Well, actually, yes, but I want to refine that a little bit. We don't want to ever push through an edge. What we're doing is we're actually opening to the edge. And so, and language obviously is challenging here, but it's relating at the edge that actually begins to dissolve the personality structure. And that's what we're wanting to do, because we can push through and feel better too, really.
But no, you know, I misspoke, because
yeah,
you did say before about being gentle.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that this compassion for oneself, which of course the Buddha talked about quite a bit, you know, I think is a crucial thing, and I did misspeak. You did explain that better before.
Okay. So if you think about in our model, the way we work is we say that the
the personality was actually created off of a blueprint of our essence.
And if you think about the personality structure, the whole thing, the parts that are working and the parts that are not working, as a defensive structure, then the issue and the ability to stay with that edge kind of becomes like a little bit of a water against the waves against the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of waves to reshape and to wear away that rock. So the staying and opening to our distress dissolves something, and we find that life will rise up and meet us in a way that is often wildly unpredictable. And then we have to be able to develop the capacity to be with that unpredictability, that spontaneous arising, which can be wonderful but wildly frightening.
Thank you. That was a good clarification, and I think it's a whole great concept, actually. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole.
I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Jeff in Iowa.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I see a number of couples, and there are times when one member of the couple or both members of the couple are functioning at a level where while I see these things you're talking about alive and possible in each and all of us, it seems like where they're at personality-wise, how they're interacting with each other, it would be very hard to bring this consciously into the dialogue. Things like, might have a male partner who's just very regularly consumed with black and white thinking, inability to recognize when he's raising his voice and being intimidating, those types of things.
Uh-huh.
So it can be just a process of really trying to help him just get some basic self-awareness about how he's presenting, what he's feeling, how these types of behaviors and the way he's communicating are impacting other people, including the partner in the room. So do you at times, can you talk about the way that you apply this work to couples who are where there's this level of kind of personality kind of problem or communication skill difficulty? So is my question coming through?
Yeah. I think
great.
Very well. But could Jeff, in the example that you're giving, could you say what the presenting issue is of the couple? Why they're there?
Yeah. Just spiraling negativity, repeated conflicts, just small things, issues turning into big problems. As far as talking about how much was spent on a jacket turns into a relationship-threatening outburst, that type of stuff.
Yeah, so that's more than enough material to bring that other conversation in. See, the you do need a certain level of heat or a radical level of boredom. Either one works. But if there is an experience of spiraling negativity and a repeated issue, I will often use some portion of a session to establish a kind of a context for why we enter relationship with a particular person. And I will often kind of talk about that the other person is actually calling forth from us a deeper part of us that we actually long to connect with.
Mm.
And so it is helpful, I believe, for a third party like a guide to, and Marlena might answer this differently, but to help point out that black and white thinking has a particular effect on the environment. But another way of going is to create a context where the couple understands that there is something that the partner is experiencing that is actually calling us to take a journey that we wouldn't normally want to take. It's calling for something deeper from us.
And if they can catch on to that, and obviously people right now who are coming to us through the book, so they've already signed up for that program, and I understand
right.
not everybody is working with clients who've signed up for that program. But I myself, in my work with couples, I let them know I'm not going to work behaviorally. I'm not going to actually, sometimes we'll have a behavioral technique employed to, you know, cool down the system enough to let them look at it. But I immediately start with, like in this man's case, that, you know, I ask him to take responsibility for the situation that is arising between them. And I might press on that for 2 or 3 months until he can begin at least to acknowledge that he's contributing to, and that and there are various ways of having that happen. And sometimes we have to look into the family of origin to say, okay, is the experience you're having with your partner similar to the experience you had with a parent? Another way of doing it, a great way of doing this, sorry, I'm rambling here a little bit. The great way of doing this is to have each partner map their relationship history. And if you can illustrate that they are having some similar experiences across relationships, they're going to have to begin to acknowledge that it has something to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that's a starting point. It's very difficult to have the rest of this dialogue with a person who hasn't taken responsibility for their participation in what's arising.
Yeah, I think I get a sense of the client you're talking about, and they are particularly difficult. And as Jet said, it helps to have a book out that kind of sets out the expectation of the kind of work that one does. But and even with that, you know, we still will get, you know, the person who's not able yet to take responsibility and all that, even as much as they want to. But, you know, I think that's where, for me, the concept of identifying what the main personality strategy is, or what the main personality identification is, because let's say with this man, is that there's a certain way that he sees himself. There's a certain way that he wants to be mirrored back. And so I think entering the arena that way with him would be very helpful, because on one hand, you're allying with him, and you're also wanting to hear and open up his storyline of, you know, where does he not get the kind of affirmation or the kind of acknowledgement? You know, what kind of person does he want his wife or partner to see him as? You know, does he want to see himself as frugal? Does he want to see himself as responsible? Does he want to see himself as the one who keeps order in the family? And so there's a, you know, when you're getting with him and with all of us, when you're getting that level of reactivity, there's a personality pattern and a personality identity that's feeling very threatened and is fighting for its life. It's about to lose its grip, and it's fighting for its life, which is where the escalation occurs. So as a way of trying to, without necessarily even saying it, to acknowledge the fear behind that potential dying off, is to begin to give it some life and to value what it's trying to do. And then from that point, what you can do is what Jet is saying, because when an identity says, I am this, and I am this necessarily excludes other things that I cannot be. And that's why we defend so much. You know, I'm the kind of person who this and that, which then spells out, then I'm the kind of person who does not or cannot feel whatever or cannot experience. And so you begin then to show them that there's a whole aspect of who they are that they're turning their backs on and alienating themselves and abandoning themselves in that place. And as Jet was saying, you know, that takes months. It's not a one-time intervention, and you're going to have to do all the regular traditional work. But whenever you see any small opening or a breath being taken,
then you can begin to weave this different program that over time, hopefully, some breakthrough will happen for that person, or something in his life will, you know, shine a light on something that you said about his identity that breaks down, like at work, and when it doesn't work, or when it does, and what he gets from it, and what he doesn't get from it.
I'm going to toss my Becky could put something over there. Literally.
Love.
Yeah,
literally.
Did a baby come on the line? There we go. Oh. I thought there was a question. Jeff, did that, hello? Hello? Is anybody there?
Yeah,
this can you hear me? Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
I have a question that tagged onto this. This is Barb in Bellevue, Washington.
Hi, Barb.
I have a client that the male personality of the couple, his personality, it's beyond his personality. He has been steeped in law enforcement since he was young, and his entire work life is based on his ability to maintain control, discount or, you know, shut out emotion. He's very willingly in couples counseling with his newlywed wife to work on this, but his struggle is so much of his time is based on not going to the edge. And how does he check that at the door, even of the counseling session? He wants to get in touch with his feelings, but it's very threatening. I mean, he now works for the Secret Service. So how do you balance that between one environment and then the intimate couple environment?
So you're saying that the work, if he were to be able to do it, actually would threaten his livelihood?
He feels...
He thinks, all right.
Well, and at times, his life is in danger if he can't bring that wall down between intimate life at home and work.
Right. I mean, you know, that I think this is an example again of the we're all sort of split in an aspect of some internal conflict, of some internal dilemma. You know, we want to be committed, but we're afraid to lose our freedom. You know, we want to achieve autonomy, but we can't let go of, a dependency style that has given us so much, right? There's always a internal dilemma that's projected, usually outside. You know, I want to be able to express myself fully and be who I am, but you're stopping me. And, you know, that's really the work of projection, of sort of seeing that what we have created outside in our life is just a reflection of some inside split. So he's really coming to the office and saying, I have an internal split. I want intimacy. And I've come from a place in my life where I've created and still have where it's about not being intimate. It's about having control and self-preservation. And so he's really kind of expressing a very large divide here between not closeness and intimacy, but really a sense of being in control and not really present with oneself, being in survival mode, you know?
Right.
And so even if he were not at this work, at this job, I suspect that would get played out in his life. So in a way, don't get caught into that trance and just see it as, you know, that's just how it's manifesting with him. It could manifest a number of ways with a woman who's being abused and, you know, and is afraid, you know, for her life. And obviously, you know, that we wouldn't do that work with someone like that. But I'm just, you know, internally, the psyche would be scared for its life. And so you would actually work with that. That's what we're saying about the edge. The edge is the opening to the path. We're not trying to get past the edge. We're not trying to even get through the edge. We're trying to relate to the edge. We're trying to meet it. And in the meeting it, there's an enlargement of the self that has to occur as you meet the dilemma, because you're trying to encompass two sides of your nature or two sides of your development. So I would really, that's where his heat is. He has a desire, obviously, with his new bride, that is kind of holding his deep desire and longing for intimacy and connection and transparency, and all of that goes, you know, everything. And for him to let down his defenses and not be in control and feel his fear as well. And then there's the other side. And that's both parts of where he is and where he needs to feel the stretch and the divide in himself. And what's that like? What's it like to hold both of those reality? How do you suffer here? How can you not hold both at the same time? What happens when you try to hold both at the same time? Which side do you go to? And then try to ease that flipping back and forth that people will do, that sort of ambivalence. That's not really holding both. The ambivalence is hopping from one side to the other. There's no heat in ambivalence except maybe you're annoyed with yourself. But it's, you know, go ahead.
I have talked to him literally about holding the tension of opposites. That's been a conversation we've had.
Yes.
Thank you. This is very interesting.
You know, so, I don't know if you're saying this, but certainly for me, when I approach something and I notice that the client either can't or won't or is uncomfortable, I sort of lose sometimes my own my own grounding or my own knowing that that we need to stay with it longer and to stay with that discomfort and say, so tell me what happens to you when I suggest that. So you're actually saying, I'm willing to be in relationship with you no matter what arises in you when I ask that question. It could be, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Or and then you stay with the I don't know. How is it for you, and especially with him, a person in his caliber, to recognize that there's something, some divide in himself that he doesn't know what to do or how to be? How is it to not know? So you actually, that's where you follow where he's going, and then you begin to kind of lead it into an opening. So whatever he presents, you become in relationship with that and encourage him to be in relationship with that.
I have a question. Do you have a brief example of something that you could share with us that you could think of?
That illustrates what piece?
Just going to this edge, or resistance to going to the edge, or just the faith in that organicity of the unknown?
Well, pretty much that's all we do. I mean, that would be kind of the center of what we do. And in the example that we're talking about with this person involved in law enforcement, the concept that we check something at the door in order to be one person in one place and another person in the other place is all steeped in personality. So.
Mm-hmm.
So that itself has to be revealed.
How much do you set up when the couple first comes in? How much teaching do you do to talk about personality, you know, maybe going to your edge, being uncomfortable, working differently? I mean, it just sounds like having to set up mindfulness and also what kind of homework might you give?
Well, certainly reading the book. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a helpful tool.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're absolutely right. I think there has to be a lot of education that is interspersed in the work that you're doing. I think you judge and evaluate how much the person can hear in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If all you say is, you know, that I see relationship as and love as trying to grow us. You know, that's kind of an easy language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really wants us to become more of ourselves, and relationship is a wonderful place to actually discover. And you just, you know, it may be as little as you say, and then when the opportunity arises, like here, like you're talking about the edges, you say things like, yeah, this is a place where we don't feel so good about ourselves. Is that what's happening to you? So you do a little kind of education, and then you bring it to direct experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say, what's it like when you don't feel good about yourself?
I mean, you're normalizing or trying to normalize something that's actually quite radical,
yes.
And that's not at all seen in our culture. So, I understand exactly what you're talking about, but there's such a resistance to that place of not knowing.
Well, that's true.
you know,
sometimes what really helps is also, I think we've seen this used, is when you ask what the person desires deeply. You know, if they could let go of, you know, and then, you know, sometimes, you know, they have wants. But if you go to the deepest desire of what they really long for, then that can be kind of the fulcrum that you may use, because our desires can help us deal with the tremendous fear that we have. But if we don't remember or value or validate that thing that we long for, then we forget really that something much deeper has made us walk into the office. Mm-hmm. So that sometimes can really help. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we want to return a little bit to, because I'm just noticing the time, we want to return to the some of the points that we're talking about here and apply them to a therapeutic condition. So we're talking about basically clients coming in, and a number of you are really giving you know, examples like, okay, you know, what do you do with this construct, or what do you do with this rigidity, or what do you do with this reactivity? And this is where the ability for the therapist to, as Marlena was saying, find their own epicenter and their own sense of ground, and also be willing to use what's coming up as their issue. To use the, I know we're all doing this because I'm hearing this in your questions. It's like that if you imagine yourself in relationship with the 40 or 80 or 100 people in your practice, however many people you're working with, that, you know, you're placing yourself on your own edge, and learning to work with that place where you begin to contract in ever more subtle ways, and to pick that up. And when you gain a facility with picking up your slight contractions, you begin to become this very sensitive kind of guidance system to what's happening in the field of the room. And you will actually pick up the contraction that's about to occur with a couple before it escalates, and or you'll be able to point out or come into relationship with the thought system that's showing up in the room as a defense before it's actually brought into the room overtly. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to begin to ask them to open up to places where they're contracted, but not so contracted that they can't actually relate to it. It brings everything much, it cuts it to an earlier place and brings the work out at a more subtle level, so that they're not actually over the edge and really just needing a lot of holding space to work through the decompensation. And so that's where we really want to emphasize that this work on the part of the guide is what is going to change what's actually happening in the room more than any education you're going to do in the room. Your presence is going to what is going to produce an environment within which this work will naturally unfold. The more you are grounded here, the more the work will flow in that direction without as much education as one might think would be necessary. So really what Jed is underlining, which is a general theme, whether we're being therapists or whether we're being partners and mates, it's the question of where we are relating from, right? Where is our base of operation? And it's very, it's challenging to not get caught up and respond or react to the client's maneuvers. To really pull us into their thought process. And so, you know, I think that's what we get, you know, we train and retrain and get ourselves back to get to be seated in our center as therapists, is to notice how we kind of leave sort of our own frame,
and sometimes that's good, but to always come back to, this is the way I'm working. This is the way I truly believe that transformation will happen. And so when you relate from this place, you notice that you will respond to those, as Jet was doing the vertical drop with Linda, you know, without doing that, there are these very subtle moments that you know as a therapist where the client has paused, where there is, some fear that just showed in their eyes, just some subliminal eruption from the inside that wants to be seen, that wants to be related to, that was allowed to come through in the midst of the thrashing. And as a therapist, that's what you want to relate to. That's what you want to notice. That's what you want to say, oh, I just saw this. And so you begin to literally, condition the environment to say, that's where I'm going to be relating and who I think is real, who just came into the room. That's where intimacy is. And, the biggest, convincer, if you will, of this work is to help give people an experience that's different than the one they're used to, that's valuable to them. When they can have, and they may not even know what it is consciously, but some part of them, as we all know, does. That experience of contact in that one moment, that experience of being seen, an aspect of them that has always been ignored and that they have succeeded in hiding from the world. When that is met, there's an experience that they'll have that will bring them back and that you'll begin to be able to build on.
One of the things that we see all the time is that a couple will go through this, immensely difficult conversation, and then I think I mentioned this earlier, that they'll arrive, like Linda did, at peace or some essential state. It may be love or compassion, I think Nicole mentioned, but some essential state will rise up. And you'll know that it's an essential state when it pervades the room, by the way, when serenity arises or equanimity and the whole room becomes, I'm sure you've all experienced this, kind of silent and deep. When that happens, we tend to rest there a little bit. And the longer we can rest in that essential state, the more that state will begin to fill in the cracks and the places that were, as I said, moved through the holes and the openings. And the more comfortable, as Marlena said, we'll get with the contracted places, because we've gotten a direct experience that there is another part of ourselves that is actually below the defense structure. That's what we're afraid of. If you ask anybody in a session, individual or couple, what are you afraid of in the middle of a contraction, is they'll often say that there'll be no one there. There's nobody actually below this thing I've created. And to get a direct experience that there is always someone there is such a profound healing that it does set one's course into a whole new journey. That we believe over time, the more of us do this work, the more of us bring this work into our practices, that will be the riptide that can reverse this ocean of conditioning to just focus on functioning as opposed to depth of being.
And I'll sort of oscillate from what Jet said, because the greatest block to this essential place that she's talking about is, I think, what you guys are, the questions that have been brought up, which is reactivity. So the examples that you're using are people getting reactive. And it's helpful to name it that way. It's kind of like in meditation, you don't get confused with the many colors and flavors and styles. You just go, oh, reactivity. And one of the I don't know, tools or strategies that we have is to, which you need to find a way to set that up in your sessions is to interrupt the reactivity. Is to literally in the minute, in the flow that they're on, is to say, okay, stop right here. Just stop. And you need to develop whatever contract agreement that you're going to be doing that. And that, you know, want them to have that experience. And that's very, very evocative. Because most people, number one, don't let themselves be stopped. That's the whole idea of reactivity, is to not be stopped and to keep going and to perform some function. So when you can interrupt this strategy that they have, whether it's criticism, whether it's blame, whatever it is, to stop it, in that moment of stopping it, you will get a whole slew of a present experience of what happens when their strategy is not allowed to move forward. And that's usually what doesn't happen in a partnership. One person can't stop the other person. I mean, they may be both be yelling at the same time, or, you know, exchanging criticism. They can't stop each other. So I think that's a very powerful technique, if you will. And then you begin to relate to what arises when they're being stopped. You know, what do you get in touch with when I did this? What bothers you the most about it? What's going on inside of you? You know, so, you know, undefended love is like many practices, is a practice of personal inquiry, where you use the question to get to know more about what that field is that the person is avoiding. So to have a sense of what those questions are or what they are for you is really important. You know, there's always something that needs our attention when we are on a stream of reactivity. So one of the questions would be, what inside of you is needing attention? What inside of you is calling out and crying out for something from us right here, right now? So you're stopping this flow of personality, and you're attempting at least to come into direct contact right here, right now with something. We don't know what it is. We don't know what's going to happen. But that's what direct contact is.
So I think we have about 7 more minutes here, and we want to just see, check in. Are there some questions coming up about this piece or anything we've been discussing this morning?
Yeah, and I'm going to have to switch us back into Q&A mode. I put us on presentation mode because of all the feedback
We
were hearing. I would just encourage everybody that after you've unmuted your phone, when you finished speaking to the group, if you could please remember to mute your phone again. That's really helpful for all of us and reduces a lot of background noise. I'm going to go ahead. It'll take me just a moment to switch us back to Q&A mode. Okay, so we're in Q&A mode, and if you'd like to speak up and share, you can unmute by pressing star 6.
I have a quick, just a comment. I think about Dick Schwartz's work in self-leadership. Are you familiar with that?
The
concept of self?
No, I'm not actually. Okay.
No.
No. Go ahead.
Yeah.
No,
I am.
It's just a comment. Yeah. I mean, I've done parts work, and the idea is teaching people about, he just uses the word self as a way to then speak about the reactivity would then be spoken through the self leadership. Anyway, I just was curious.
Where you speak for the part.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the approach, yeah.
Where you speak, for the part who's being reactive, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he uses the term self leadership or self.
Uh-huh.
And then it's internal systems, and that you then and that self has a body, an uncontracted kind of body state, where you're much more open.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are obviously many ways to talk about this. I mean, I think the voice dialogue people also will work with that even a different way. They'll have different voices for the different parts of oneself, and then
mm-hmm.
the amalgamation of all those voices is the self. So that's talked about in different ways, but the way we work with that is
you know, we basically separate, it's even more complex than this, but there are three elements. We work with the kind of the absolute self, the essential self, and then personality. And so the absolute self is the part that we all share. And then the essential self is kind of like the soul part. It's the part that evolves. And then the personality is the fabricated self. So, you know, I think we're all kind of, there are many traditions pointing to.
No, but that's helpful to break it down for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously I'm going to have to read the book, but thank
you. Because we also have, you know, the personality. We have the compensatory personality, the one that we've developed to get attention and approval. And that's why we called it compensatory. It tries to compensate for something that we have cut off in ourselves because it wasn't valued or validated in our environment. So when I cut off parts of myself, I feel insecure. I feel inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look to develop a personality that will get me something from the environment in order to make me feel less inadequate. So the compensatory personality is that which we do to get attention and approval. And then below that, which is where the compensatory personality was birthed, is what we call the cracked identity, which is what Linda identified as that feeling or that fear that I'm actually truly unimportant and non-existent. And that's the cracked identity. And that's the work that we, you know, when you've got people who really have facility and capacity to do it, to when they dismantle the personality, they move into the cracked identity, which is one of the hardest to tolerate. It's that black hole. But we're unreferenced to our past and everything, and so there's a free fall that occurs through there, and it's one of the most powerful kind of transformative processes. But that's sort of further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
In the work that we're
what
doing.
What is the essential is soul, the personality is fabricated, and what's the absolute?
Well, if you think of the nighttime sky and you think of the stars as cutouts, and there's a big light shining through the stars, that light that shines through all the stars is the same. So that's like the absolute self. It's the part that is
non-personal.
The same. It's non-personal. But the way that light comes through each star is unique. And that is the essential self. It's the unique quality that exists for a particular being. And so that's one way of kind of distinguishing those two.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Does someone else have a comment or a question in our final 2 minutes here together?
I wanted to say something. This is Erica.
Hi, Erica.
Hi. Sometimes people are not ready in the moment to have that opening experience. I've had a couple of cases where someone did open up and felt it, and then they kind of freaked out. And like one person has a drug problem, and she got right back on the drugs. But it actually was a good thing because it got her into treatment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, the person could have a breakdown if they're not ready,
mm-hmm.
or if it's just overwhelming that they had that insight.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we wanted to say that this work is not for everyone.
It's certainly not for someone who actually is working with the lack of a solid sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to have created a solid sense of self or a personality is a prerequisite to dissolving it. And once you are working with someone who is appropriate for this work, then any ideas we have about whether they're ready or not have to be released, because at that point we're entering into the field with life and their soul and our soul, and that's the part where we spend a lot of time as guides bowing down to what life says they're ready for and they're not ready for. But to identify who this work is appropriate for is a really important step at the beginning. You know, if you're working with a community that really is really needing to develop an ability to be stable, then
mm-hmm.
that's different. So thank you. I usually yeah. mention that at the beginning, and we overlooked that. Appreciate your
comment. And I agree with you. I like the way that you sort of are relating to the left-handed gift, as we call it, that the person went into some recovery, that they were probably constructing their life to avoid that edge in themselves
and it put them in the abyss so that there could be some deep healing. Yeah, that's great.
So we need to thank you so much for being a member of the tribe this morning, and we're going to hand this over to Noah.
Okay, well, boy, I wish we had more time here. This has been just really rich, and I just want to express my thanks to you both, Jet and Marlena. The presentation for me was just much more than I expected. I just found that it was filled with lots of wisdom and experience, and really appreciated the spirit, feeling the spirit in which you both approach the work that you do. This has been, for me, one of the best presentations that we've had, and I'd really love to have you both back sometime again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Very welcome. I want to remind everybody about Jet and Marlena's website, www.undefendedlove.com. Where you can get information about their workshops, their books, and their work. I wanted also to, Linda, if you're still on the line, I just wanted to say I'm sorry if my laughter interrupted your process. It was terrible timing as you were connecting to how your mom triggers you.
I thought it was funny.
Oh, good, good. Okay, great, great. Good. Well, then we can laugh about it some more. Let's see, a couple other important announcements. On January 30th, we're welcoming Susan Heitler to GoodTherapy.org. She's presenting on conflict resolution skills for couples and counselors. It's very interesting because I think it's a very different, more cognitive approach to doing couples work. And Susan's well-known, has what many of you probably have heard of her video, The Angry Couple. So she has a lot to offer, and feel free to join us for that. And I also wanted to mention, in case anybody's interested, we have a new contract open for a new continuing education coordinator to take over this very important part of what we do at GoodTherapy.org. Unfortunately, Whitney, who's our current coordinator, has to leave for personal reasons, and we're sad about it. But looking forward to, seeing who can continue to help us with this. So those are all the announcements. I need to give out the ending code, and I'm going to do that now. You got the start code when we started, and now the ending code, which you'll need for continuing education, is YOU, Y-O-U. Again, the ending code is YOU, Y-O-U. And I'll be sending an email to everybody with instructions on how to apply for the continuing education for today's event. I want to thank everybody for being a part of this. It was a wonderful group today, and I hope everybody took away as much as I did. Again, my a deep bow to Jet and Marlena for taking the time to present to us today. Bravo for the good work that you're both doing. And I hope we can stay in touch. And if there are any other questions or concerns, I'm going to hang out here on the line for a little while.